So just to say, this talk that I've written here on the retreat is really mainly from my notes of Subhuti's recent visit to the RBC. So if you were there for most of it, you'll be familiar with much of the material. So it's really me trying to communicate Subhuti's insights. They're much greater than my own, so I feel that the best thing I can do really is communicate those. I've called my talk on only the trying. Yeah? Only the trying. So ordination, as we all know, we commit ourselves to spiritual death and spiritual rebirth. And in a way, that's what I want to explore in this talk, how we commit ourselves to spiritual death and spiritual rebirth. In terms of the recent papers, it means cultivating karma nirma processes, so that dharma nirma processes can arise. Hopefully everyone's familiar with that language now from that paper, very important papers. So in a way that's what we've committed ourselves to, cultivating dharma nirma processes so that dharma nirma processes can arise. And that basically means cultivating the whole path. It means cultivating at ever higher levels integration, positive emotion, spiritual receptivity, and so on. But how I've been thinking about it is that we could say that at ordination, from then on, you're primarily committed to spiritual rebirth. That in a way, experientially and practically, comes before spiritual death. It comes before it historically in our own lives, and it probably comes before it practically in our own lives. It's this living out of this vision, if spiritual rebirth is also the stage of vision, it's living out this vision, is living true to this vision, that is what makes us order members. It's creating the conditions for this vision to arise. That's really what makes us order members, that we're committing ourselves to spiritual rebirth. After all, it's this vision, it's our vision that brought us here in the first place. The vision precedes the path, doesn't it? Spiritual rebirth is also the beginning of the path as well as, in a way, the end. Some glimmering of vision arose for all of us, probably long before we'd ever even heard of Buddhism. I was thinking one of the experiences for me that gave birth to the beginning of spiritual vision, to spiritual rebirth, was my parents taking me to see the body of my grandmother in a coffin on her bed where she died. I was only, I think, about six. Very liberal, I think, of my parents to do that. And I remember my mother saying, either my mother or my father saying, she's gone to a better place. And then one of them said, oh, she's asleep. And I thought, she's definitely not asleep. I've seen my grandmother asleep and she doesn't look like that. And I still now remember the atmosphere of that room. I remember seeing my grandmother and just thinking, what on earth has happened? It's almost as if my whole life has sort of rippled out from that. What on earth has happened? Somewhere in that, what does that mean for me? It felt like I didn't know what had happened. All it felt like all there was a huge question mark in life, suddenly. There'd been life, and now right in the centre of it was a question mark. And I think we've all had some kind of vision like that that has drawn us to the Dharma in the first place. And it's working out that vision, exploring that vision, deepening that vision that our life really needs to consist in. The Dharma merely explores that in the most rigorous, the clearest, and most helpful way. It shows us how to value that vision and to let it flourish. It gives us a real way of doing that. So I think we're primarily committed to the vision. It started us. To this desire that we must have had for something more. A sense that ordinary conventional life is inadequate. I had that, again, quite strongly when I was young. I was brought up in a small town, and I remember feeling very strongly that it was just a lie. That what people were doing, what they were saying, was a kind of lie. I didn't know what it was a lie about, but I felt instinctively that it wasn't adequate. So a large, large number of people feel this vision, this urge for something more, this sense of a higher life that could be lived. Subhuti was telling this story of Bhante, I think, coming back from doing some second-hand bookshop shopping. And he was on the tube coming back to the LBC. And he said he looked around on the tube and he thought, looking around, that he thought about 10% of people would respond to the Buddhist vision. That 10% of people, in any group of people, wanted that more. Wanted something more than the usual conventional life. Wanted something more than life as it's usually given us can give. He thought about 10%. People who want greater value to life. So the Dharma life is revealing that, discovering our potential beyond self-gratification, and then orientating our lives towards that. And it really is our duty as order members to nurture and live out that vision. In a way, that is our primary duty, to nurture and live out that vision, and then to help provide it the conditions for other people to experience that vision. People who want an experience of higher value. I think our duty as order members is to do what we can to discover that in ourselves and let it flourish, but especially create the conditions for other people to discover it and let it flourish. And then those other people can then pass it on in their turn. Without this vision, without this higher value, without this spiritual rebirth, beyond, as I say, self-gratification, in a way, modern life is basically, in the West at least, completely orientated to self-gratification. Without that, without this vision, life becomes completely level and dead. Subhuti used the image of going to a shopping mall, which I think is a really strong image for that. There's nothing in that experience that takes you upward. If you go into a shopping mall, it's completely vapid. You can feel your spirit being leached out of you somehow. There's no upward dimension. I remember I was talking with a Dharmacharini who's having a real crisis of faith and is exploring Catholicism. And what had sparked off this exploration was something Thomas Merton said, that was God was in everything. He says God is in everything. And she said that when she heard that, she thought, yes, that's what I want, God is in everything. And I was talking to her, it was a very moving conversation. We were out in this lovely cafe, we were surrounded by flowers, and I looked at her and I thought, gosh, that's true, isn't it? God is in everything. It felt experientially true to me as I looked around, talking to her, that yes, God is in everything, but you couldn't feel that in a shopping mall. You just couldn't. You could say you could, but you just can't. You can't feel in those conditions that there is this spirit. You can't think of it like that. You'd have to make it up. You know what I mean? You can where there's daffodils around in nature, but you can't if it's, I don't know, TK Maxx or whatever it is. So this sense of higher value, this sense of vision, whatever word we want to use, can never be adequately conceptualized. It's an indefinable spirit. It moves through us and at the same time completes us. I keep coming back to this line from Wallace Stevens where he talks about attuned beyond us, yet ourselves. So you've got that both things. It's attuned beyond us and yet ourselves. It both goes beyond us, and in our participation of what goes beyond us, we feel completed in a new way. And we must never try to pin that down. There is something undefinable about it. Language hints at it, but we must never try to pin it down and to reify it, to analyse it too much. It's a sort of spirit, as it were, that through Bhante founded the order. I think that's the best way to think of it, really, that he talks about himself as a spirit through him founded the order, and that spirit has been passed on to us, and we need to, we're the bearers of it now. We need to, we keep it alive by our practice, by our vision. We keep that vision alive, that spirit that Bhante, that through Bhante founded the order. And we can feel it in a direct way. We need to feel it in a direct way. It's tugging at our sleeve all the time, this Dharma Nima process, if you want to use that rather technical language, this vision, this spirit. I think I prefer spirit in a way. It's tugging at our sleeve all the time. It's not a theory. It's not an idea. It's part of the structure of things. After all, the Buddha discovered the structure of things. He didn't make it up. It's a law in the universe, like gravity or thermodynamics. There's a law that governs, as the Buddha said, the falling of apples and the appearance of a Buddha. You've got laws all the way through the universe that govern all of that. It's a natural phenomena, and therefore it is something we can feel if we're open to it, if we're spiritually receptive. It's not primarily an idea. The only essential thing to say about it, really, is it goes beyond our willing. It isn't something we can consciously will. All we can do is prepare the ground for it by cultivating the path, by cultivating integration and so forth. So T.S. Eliot says, for us there is only the trying, the rest is not our business. So this is where I get my title of my talk from, Only the Trying. For us there is only the trying, the rest is not our business. Which actually is a wonderful way of saying, talking about karma nirma processes and dharma nirma processes. For us there is only the trying, the rest is not our business. So I want to explore three things we can try. Three main areas, I think, of life, which are saying, for us there is only the trying. The rest is not our business. We need to keep an eye on the rest, because that's why we're trying, but for us there is only the trying. So I've got three, I should have looked at my watch, I've got three areas I want to look at, fairly large areas of life. So the first one is carry on learning. Very, very simple, but I think the more you think about it, the more depth it has. So one of the great dangers, I think, for order members is sort of know-it-allism, as if being an order member is a goal, whereas really being an order member is the start proper of the path. It's when you really decide to tread the path. But it's very easy for it to be seen slightly as a goal, as if you've now arrived somewhere. It was almost as if we got to the stage of no more learning, which we haven't, at least I certainly haven't, and I probably think you haven't either. So I think after ordination it becomes even more important to cultivate spiritual receptivity. In a way we need to, I think, do that more than we did before, because we're going to, it's a strange dynamic, isn't it, because we're growing up, so we will become less naive. We see people we looked up to in the early days as being wonderful, and we see them more critically, and that's a valid part of human growth. But because of that growing critical mindedness, but that growing sense, we need even more to cultivate spiritual receptivity, so as to not counteract it, because that's a genuine part of spiritual life, but so as not to lose it. We need to deepen it. I mean, it's very striking teaching newcomers. You know, I've done lots of teaching at the RBC. I'm doing this no-content course at the moment. And one of the reasons why it's just so enjoyable is because people are incredibly receptive to me. Now, of course, that receptivity, you know, is based on not knowing me very well, quite a lot of positive projection, caveat, etc., etc., etc. We know all that. But yet, that spiritual receptivity means that I can speak much more deeply. Sometimes in order context, I just can't speak very deeply because there isn't a space to speak into. We all know too much, in the wrong sense, and so one can't sort of speak. It's odd. But when you're teaching in a room where people really want to hear what you want to say, it's amazing. You find that you can speak and you say things, you're in touch with something that you're not usually in touch with. So somehow we need to keep that level of spiritual receptivity whilst growing up and losing our naivety. I think that is a very difficult balance. And much of the earlier years of ordination, I think, are working out that tricky balance of growing up, and even, I think, sometimes growing out of the shadow of your Kalyana Mitras, even discovering they're not as developed as you'd hoped, at the same time as cultivating more and more spiritual receptivity. So this really means we need to carry on being taught, I think, primarily. And being spiritually receptive, obviously, to those who've gone beyond us, who've gone further on the path, or who are more committed to cultivating and sharing the vision. Yeah. Just simply that. I mean, I'm very struck, you know, preparing this talk, I was thinking again about Subhuti. I've been literally sitting at his feet, taking notes of what he says, for the last, I think it must be the last 25 years, something like that, 24, 25 years. He was on the first retreat, first going for refuge retreat here, and I've literally been sitting and writing notes from what he says ever since. And I was really gratified by that. I really feel that I've gained immeasurably from him. People say they want a teacher, don't they? But, you know, I've got more teachers than I know what to do with. You know what I mean? There I was, sitting at his feet for all this time. He's constantly reimagining the Dharma, constantly reimagining our great project. And I've learnt so much from him. I was wanted to also really rejoice in Satyaraja. I really learnt so much from Satyaraja, being on the course with him. Not just in how he teaches, which I did learn a lot from, but his being, you know. If you ever want a Buddhist teacher, try Satyaraja. You know, you just bite him, and he's a Buddhist all the way through. I mean, it's just obvious. Don't bite him, because that's not nice. You know. And I could go on, I could talk about Dharma deeper, I could talk about so many who all of us can learn from. And it's quite simple. You say, please tell me. You ask them what they think and so on. Yeah. So part of it, I think, of carry on learning is being taught by people who you look up to. Of course, the other part is studying. Keeping coming back to study, particularly study of Bhante, because Bhante's vision of the Dharma is so profound. But especially we need to keep filling our mind with Dharma ideas. I think this is really, really important. We need to keep filling our mind with Dharma ideas. If we don't do that, our mind quite naturally fills up with worldly ideas. You've got one set or the other. A lot of study isn't really study in the sense of trying to get to grips with what does this mean. It's just putting Dharma ideas into your mind, rather than worldly ideas, rather than conventional perspectives. Keep on putting Dharma ideas into your mind. It's as if the sort of drab waters of convention get thrust aside the more Dharma ideas you put into your mind. We just can't stop doing that. Study is probably too grand a word. Just keep putting those ideas into your mind. We need to toughen the muscles of our mind with Dharma ideas. Otherwise, when we're under pressure, we won't have any Dharma ideas to draw on. I'm afraid I was looking back on the whole scandals with Bhante and his sex life and so on. It really struck me, and strikes me even more so now, that most of our reaction to it was nothing to do with the Dharma. It was nothing to do with Dharma ideas. We just ran off with conventional thought. Nobody thought, yes, but, well, some people did, but many people didn't think, yes, but what happened? Let's try and think about this. Our mind, or many people's mind, many order members' mind, just became convention. Recently I said to Bhante, looking back on it, it looks like a hysterical group reaction. And he said, that's exactly how I see it. hysterical or not, what strikes me about it is that our minds, many order members' minds at that time, were not filled with Dharma ideas. So we went straight off to the world's ideas. Yeah. Subhuti recently said that it's not order members' spiritual sincerity that needs to be questioned, but their dharmic intelligence. And I think that's very, very important. You can question people's dharmic intelligence, and we need to be constantly strengthening that muscle of dharma intelligence. So we need to be in regular contact with the Dharma at its neatest, as the Buddha said, by which he means like whiskey, at its neatest, as its least diluted. Those great bell sounds of the Dharma, we need to keep in regular contact with that. Ordination is committing ourselves to that through reflection, through active meditation and so on. If we do that, if we keep coming back to the Dharma at our neatest, then we'll be able to use the things that happen to us in ordinary life, ill health, accidents, the bum notes of the day, we'll actually use them as cues to reflect about the nature of life. But if we've not been putting Dharma ideas into our mind, we'll keep missing the moment, the late train, the frustrated desire, the boyfriend that goes off with a Cuban, nothing personal. We'll keep missing that moment and just respond with the world's stuff, if you see what I mean. Yeah? I think it seems to me that our minds are made up, it seems to me, designed to smooth things over, to rationalise, to make excuses, to paper over the cracks, to act as if we're immortal, to act as if there isn't that big question mark right at the heart of life. I think we're designed to keep turning away from that. We probably couldn't have evolved without that. So at ordination, we're committing ourselves to reflecting on the gaps that show up in life. So when we paper over our life and it splits, we're committing ourselves to think, well, there's an opportunity to reflect on the true nature of existence. If we haven't got the Dharma enough in our mind, we won't. We'll just do the things that ordinary conventional people do, whatever that is. Sob in my case. So at ordination, we're committing ourselves to seeking out those moments when the gaps show, when life doesn't go the way we want it to. And this is one of the primary meanings of spiritual death, that we really see in the ordinary running of our life that we cannot make it work, that we cannot make it go the way we want it to go. So I think we need this. We need a reflective enough life. We need a Dharma-rich life, so we're quicker at catching ourselves trying to escape, quicker at trying to catch ourselves trying to escape from the realities of our situation, trying to escape from the burden of our karma, for instance. In other words, the burden of conscience to do with what you've done in the past. It's so easy to want to escape that, to not take responsibility for that. Trying to escape the facts of the situation, the existential facts of old age, sickness and death, the existential facts of impermanence and dukkha. Or we try to fit the world into the story we like to tell ourselves. Recently I was talking to an order member trying to communicate something, and it was impossible, it felt to me. Not impossible, that's too much. But his story was so fixed, there was no way I could influence it. The story had been set. He knew exactly what had happened, and I couldn't. It felt to me, perhaps I wasn't being skillful enough, but I couldn't influence the story. Yeah. And it's a real danger as we get older that our stories about ourselves get more and more fixed, and of course self-serving. Only being in rich enough contact with the Dharma will you make you start to reflect and question the story you tell yourself. I think for me this is a sign of maturity, when you give your life story, when you're no longer so sure about your life. You're no longer sure what character you were. Were you the victim or the victimizer? I used to tell my story very much in terms of being the victim, but it was an edited version of my story. As you grow up in the Dharma life, there should be a questioning of everything that happened in the past. The stories you told yourself that rationalised and served who you thought you were. So that's my first area, I think, is we need to carry on learning. Carry on learning by going on retreat, carry on learning by teaching. I think one of the great ways of carrying on learning, if you can teach, is to teach, because it makes you do things like write a talk instead of write poems, which is probably what I would have been doing. So I've saved the world for some more poems. So teaching, carry on doing Mitra study, friendship, studying Bhante. And the other thing, of course, is things like solitary retreats. They're so often where your reflections go deeper. Subhuti's been talking about the shock of solitude, where you really realise the burden of your karma. It's so often on solitary retreat, isn't it, that you're sitting there quite happily in your meditation and suddenly you go, oh, you see what you've done and you see quite clearly how you were acting. It's not the story anymore, you just think, oh, that was me showing off, that was me being tacky, that was me, whatever it was. It's on solitary is often that you see your karma, don't you? You see the burden of your karma and you wince at it. So the second area I wanted to talk about, the second great trying, is committing our life to karma nirma processes. So I think Eliot is right. For us, there is only the trying. For us, there is only the trying. And as order members, we're convinced that there is only the trying, in the sense that there is only ethical action. There is only kusala karma. There is only working in cooperation with karma nirma processes. It is the only way to live. It's that nothing else really works. That's what we've said when we got ordained, I think, is that we're convinced of that, at least effectively convinced of that. We won't be really convinced of that, otherwise we'd be stream entrants. But we really think that only ethical life will do it. That for us there is only that kind of trying. We've committed ourselves to the good life as the only life worth living and as the only life that actually works. That getting and spending and so forth just doesn't work. That acting out of selfishness, etc., just doesn't work. It doesn't give you what you want. So it's the only life worth living and the only life that works. And we've said when we were ordained that we'll come back to that again and again. We'll keep coming back to that. As soon as we've lost track, as soon as we've noticed that we've lost track, we'll come back. We come back through confession, through apology, through helpfulness, cooperation, through generosity, through all of our ethical actions. We come back to karma nirma processes, to kusala karma. And in a way, as order members, that's all we need to do. That's all we need to exemplify is the trying, only the trying. And of course, only the trying means also the failing, by definition. To try something means that you can fail it at it. And that's fine. Bhante recently apparently said that he's not concerned with human failings, he's concerned with right view. Human frailty, sorry. He's not concerned with human frailty. So all of us are riven with human frailty, and all we need to do is apologise for that, confess that, explore that, really trying to bring out. But it's not unusual. So in our exemplifying the trying, is also sort of exemplifying the failing and saying, I failed there. I didn't do that there. I think it's a very simple thing to do, but often people are really heartened by it if you say, I did that wrong, or yes, I made a mistake. So often that's what people need to hear from us. But then the rest is not our business. The rest is not our business. And we all know this, don't we? But it's worth remembering again and again that through ethics, our consciousness arises in a deeper, richer, and more interconnected way. A new self arises that's more integrated, more aesthetic. The mind appears more pliable, more plastic. You're more able to see into the heart of things. I mean, it's very striking, isn't it, just being on this short reunion. I feel that so obviously more all of those things now than I was when I arrived. I feel a bit deeper. My experience feels a bit richer. I feel more interconnected with you all and more easily, naturally connected with you rather than some sort of having to make an effort to connect. My mind feels more pliable, more plastic, more ductable. I'm a bit more on the ball. My mind's more subtle. And in a way, that's all that karma nirma is that you, by acting ethically, by acting for the good, your mind, yourself, myself, appears in a new way. It appears in this new form. And that's, in a way, the great gift that we've got and the great gift that we can share with others, that you can change your mind. And in changing your mind, you're changing your life. There's less grasping, you're more connected with others. Just by just being on retreat together, meditating, studying a bit, doing ritual, talking with each other, not turning on our phones, not da-da-da. It's quite naturally happens, doesn't it? It doesn't feel like a huge effort. But a new self has already arisen. We've not been here very long. And all of us on Kukiloka felt that so strongly, that a new self arose. I mean, Subhuti makes this point that in modern Western Buddhism, there's again and again this sort of assumption that insight is something that you can grasp, something that you can have, get a grasp of. But he's saying, well, it's not like that at all. All you need to do is work with karma nirma processes. By practicing ethics over and over again, deeper and deeper, we're gradually creating conditions for a completely different mindset to emerge. That's what we're doing. We're doing it quite naturally, just as the Buddha said. It's just like planting things in the ground. Over and over, deeper and deeper, by acting ethically, you're creating the conditions for a completely new mindset to emerge. Serving people, friendship, all those ordinary things, helpfulness, alters the way that we are. It changes the structure of us so that we become a closer fit with reality. So it's not that insight is something that we go and get. We, by karma nirma process, we just become a closer fit with reality. I even feel that a little bit here. I just feel like things are smoother. My experience runs more smoothly. I feel much more easy pleasure in other people's company. I appreciate more quickly. My mind is just a bit more fit for reality, fits reality a bit more. All we need to do is keep doing that, trying and failing in doing that. As we do that, our mind becomes more and more workable, more and more pliable, and eventually Dharma Nirma processes can take over. They can actually, a willing beyond our willing, a will from outside of ourselves, as it were, can take over. So, in a way, there is only the trying, us trying to create this new consciousness. And we do it every time we meditate, we do it every time we're honest, we do it every time we confess, every time we help somebody do the washing up. We create a new self that fits reality better. So that the tug of the Dharma Nirma can actually have purchase on us. It's here all the time, but it doesn't have much purchase on us because we're so, I don't know, somewhere else, wherever it is we are, we're so caught up in ourselves, really, that we can't feel the tug of something beyond ourselves. So that's my second area, is to cultivate, committing our life to karma nirma processes, to ethical action, to kusala karma, to reshaping ourselves so that we fit reality, so reality can take over. So my third area, a bit more briefly, is connecting with Dharma Nirma processes and letting the vision take over. So whilst for us there is only the trying, it's not completely true to say the rest is not our business. It's more like we need to keep the rest in the corner of our eye, keep open to the rest. In other words, whilst we're trying to cultivate the path, we need to practice being open to the goal. We need to consciously practice being open to the goal, to Dharma Nirma processes, as Bhante's been calling it. And as I said, Dharma Nirma processes, Subhuti tells us, are here right now. They're tugging on us right now. But the trouble is, there are a lot of other things tugging on us right now. There's many pulls on us right now. So we very easily resist. We very easily evade, we we very easily want to escape, as I said already. And working with karma nirma, working with ethics, means aligning ourselves more and more to the dharma nirma process. I mean, really, it is as simple as that, as ordinary as that, as day-to-day as that, just aligning ourselves more and more so that the main pull is from that process, not all the other things that are pulling at us. And the place that we're most likely to experience dharma nirma processes is in the collective situation. That's where we're going to experience it, in the community. In the community, in the heart of the community of men and women who are trying to align themselves with the vision, who are open to that spirit that formed the order through Bhante, who are in touch with that spirit. It's by being in touch with them together that we're most likely to experience the pull of the vision, the pull of the dharma nirma processes. That spirit, as I say, that founded the order through Bhante. And this is what spiritual rebirth really is. It's a larger objective reality that calls on us to transform ourselves. It's a really felt thing. It calls on us to transform our life. It draws us beyond self-clinging. It draws us beyond self-gratification. And we experience it in the collective, primarily. We experience it in this sangha we're trying to develop, in this community we're trying to develop that crosses continents, crosses all kinds of divisions. We're going to experience it mostly in this collective. It's a sense of serving some overarching spirit. I think service is a key part of dharma nirma process. You need to be serving something that goes beyond you. And you can sense it sometimes in the atmosphere between us, in a certain delight, a sense of the mind waking me up, is how I experience it. A sense that together we're more than the sum of our parts. I mean, you were saying how much you enjoy today sitting on the grass in a ring in the tea break. And you were talking about this special atmosphere that there was between us. Friends just wanting to be together for no ideological reason, not because it's good for them, not even because they're trying to develop friendship, but just because there's this thing that they want to be part of. There's this atmosphere, there's this good thing. They just want to. It's simple as that. We just want to. I feel that sometimes in my community. There are times, very occasionally, when a few of us friends are sitting around the dinner table, and we're just there because we want to be. We're not trying to do anything. We're not trying to be friends, even. We're not trying to work at friendship or anything like that. We're not practicing our listening skills. We just want to be with each other because there's this kind of atmosphere that completes us, attuned beyond us, and yet ourselves. So it's really, I think if we can think about it like that, it's really clear that it's not an idea. It's something that you can actually experience sitting in a ring on the grass. All you need to do is notice, oh, there's that thing again. There's that energy again. There's that spirit moving amongst us again. So it's not an idea. It's not even an ideal in the doctrinal sense, in the thinly heroic sense. It's an atmosphere. A pervading sense of uplift is how I usually experience a sort of subtle, benign, unifying sense of uplift that anyone who is participating in can feel. Of course, the negative to that is if you're not participating in it, you can't feel it. Which is why you can never really watch a puja. You know, we say, you know, come to the puja, but you don't need to take part, you can just watch. You can't watch puja. Puja is that thing that appears between us sometimes, not very often, when we're practicing that thing called puja. But if you're not participating in it, you don't have it. It's not there. Just like you can't watch somebody meditate. You could say, now I'm going to do a meditation. If you're a bit uneasy with that, you could come and watch. You know, you would not have any idea from coming to watch what they're doing. Puja, I think, is exactly the same. Community is exactly the same. You have to participate in this community to experience it. I mean, this is, I think, makes it clear that this experience we sometimes have when you give a talk. Sometimes, occasionally, I've given a talk where something comes into the room. And I'm not clear whether it's to do with me. I seem to be sort of taking a particular part in that drama at that particular moment, but could be replaced in that moment by any of my close friends. I remember having this weird experience in Florence once, where I'd been asked to go and speak to somebody about the Dharma. I don't know why they asked me, I can't remember quite. But I was there with Jnanavacharya and Paramahansa. And I stepped out of the car to go and speak to this person. And I had this weird experience that in another world, Paramahansa was stepping out of the car. And in another world, Jnanavacharya was stepping out of the car. It just happened that in this particular world at this time, I was stepping out of the car. And sometimes I felt like giving talks that just at this particular time, I'm doing the bit at the front and you're listening. But if this atmosphere is here, it kind of appears between us. And then the next time it's you doing this bit and me listening. And I think it makes sense. Something I've tried to understand for a long time, when people sometimes say, that was a really, really good talk, thank you very much. And you sometimes say, what was it you liked particularly? And people say, well, I don't know. Or was it this point or that point? Because, you know, you want constructive feedback and so on. But I think sometimes what people are saying is, I felt that thing. That thing that I so value. That without it, life has got this awful flatness to it. This awful dead end to it. I felt that thing. And it was something to do with you saying some things. It wasn't in the jokes. It wasn't in the this or the that. And it was something about that, though. I felt that thing. The other time I remember experiencing it was waiting for Bhante once in an order, in a convention. I don't know whether you remember this, such an order, but Bhante was coming, I think, I can't remember what he was coming for, he was coming in. We were all in the gym together, all the order members, there must have been 400 of us, something like that. And it took quite a while for him to come. And we all just stood there waiting, because we all stood up to welcome Bhante. And we all just stood there. And gradually, as we stood there, there was this thing in the room. You know, this. We were all standing there, waiting for Bhante, waiting for the teacher, waiting for our beloved teacher. And he didn't come, but there was this thing in the room. There was the spirit that, through Bhante, created the order, it felt like. And so many people said, did you feel it, that thing? I think if you think like that, it's much more... I can resonate with that. I know that. I felt that in my body. Sometimes our ideals, and I don't know, and sound good. insight, the 10 boomers, it sounds nice. But I can feel that. I feel that. And I feel it in the collective. I feel it very strongly on times of order weekends. You know, I schlep up from London, and I'm always a bit... You know, I always have this moment from the car park to signing in is the most difficult, because I just get to the Silver Birches and I think, hang on, I don't really like sort of religious spiritual things. I don't want to do this. I don't even like the countryside. You know that experience when you get out of the car, you think it's very quiet. You know, I've been living in Bethnal Green. There's not even a Costa. You know, this weird sort of transition. But then quite quickly, just being together, something emerges between, something very happy. But not happy to do with people getting what they want, a kind of special kind of happiness that is a shared atmosphere. I mean, that's one of the reasons why I really want to emphasise that everyone goes on order, National Order Weekend. You know, I think it's what the Buddha was getting at about meeting in large numbers. I've never really got that. It always just sounds like the Buddha is suddenly getting a bit, you know, number conscious. You know, he just wants large numbers. You know, you sort of think... A lot of people don't like large numbers and all that sort of stuff. I don't mind large numbers myself, especially if I can talk to them all, because I'm a natural show-off. But I think the Buddha's getting at that when a community meets together in large numbers, you're more likely to feel this thing, this pull, this spirit amongst us. And when you experience that, you're already part of it. That is Dharma Nyama processes reaching into your life. That's when you start to feel them in your life. a sense of community that is more than the individual, without denying the individual. That's the remarkable thing, that at times in Order Weekend, you really feel that, that there's space for everyone, but there's more. There's something more than everyone. So there's more the individual without denying them. Again, attuned beyond us and yet ourselves. Banti talks about this earlier on as the third order of consciousness. You've got individual consciousness, you've got group consciousness, and then you've got this third order of consciousness. Attuned beyond us and yet ourselves. So the spiritual life for order members is really about serving that vision, about giving yourself, giving myself over to it, serving it as best as we can. So I think one of the main ways we do that is just by turning up, very, very simply, turning up to this reunion, turning up to order weekends, turning up to your chapter, turning up to the convention, turning up to communication, turning up to life, turning up to meditation. Just keep turning up. And then when you've turned up, well, you may as well really turn up and actually switch on, starting to sound like a 60s person. A lot of it is just turning up. But then the other thing I think is so important is that there needs to be something sufficiently vital between us, sufficiently spiritually intense, sufficiently spiritually vivid between us in our communications. One of the dangers of chapters is you get well-meaning order members meeting up in a group, having well-meaning discussions where they never really get to the nub of things. We need to be, all of us need to be having communications that take us to the edge of our ego clinging. That is what a sangha is for, not just to agree with each other. Now please don't get me wrong, I'm not wanting to go back to fierce friendship and all that sort of thing. So easily misunderstood, and there's been a whole redressing of that, and quite rightly, there needs to be love and friendship first. But there also does need to be confession, real shame, and there needs to be a mutual helping each other focus the issues, not merely encouraging each other to do what we already want to do. It's too easy, folks. It's also too easy to tell people what you think and give them a piece of your mind, rather more my style, but it is rather too easy to do that. We need together to find a way of creating a community that has that kind of intensity in its communications that take us to the edge of our ego clinging. And then we'll participate in this vision, this larger third order of consciousness. Of course, one of the things that really struck me when I went on the... we had the meeting for the Gokuloka last year. We all met, as you've all met, at Pavmaloka to talk about the course. I had gone 21 years before. When I went 21 years before, nearly everybody was in a community or working a tea-based right livelihood. I think there was one or two, literally, that weren't, and there were 17 of us. It was the absolute reverse of that a year or so ago. Most people weren't doing those things, and that's probably going to be quite a lot of how things are. And one of the new challenges of our community is not to pejoritise that. So often there's been, you know, finger-pointing about things like that. And very often those very people who go off and then get married and have children later on, the gung-ho ones are usually the worst. They usually then gung-ho in the opposite direction and punish you in a new way. you can see I speak from bitter experience. But I've been, you know, having people are so into Banti one generation and they're so out of Banti the next. You feel like, say, look, don't do either, you know. Anyway, never enough time. I'm going to start to rant. But, you know, how do we create a community between us where some people are living at home with families, some people are living with their partners, some people are living in communities? There's increasingly few closed communities. A friend of mine thought there were only 5 men's closed communities in the world. I don't know whether that's true, but there's not very many. How do we create that community that's still sufficiently intense? That was the idea of communities and team-based right livelihood in the first place, to create intensity between people. How do we find a way of doing that in this new community that we're forming? And this new community that we're forming is the way it was always going to go, folks. It's not a mistake. So looking back on our early days, it feels vainglorious that we thought we would really create this sort of citadel where everyone kept sexual relationships on the edge of their mandala, which basically meant Saturday night. Actually, I'm still following that. And that's why my boyfriend's going off with a Cuban. Anyway, I'm still following that. Weep, weep. That's so true, I've distracted myself. How do we create a community with that kind of intensity that doesn't pejoratise lifestyle choices, but we're not wanting to then just have chapter meetings where we just chat, really, and then have friendships which we just fill in the time between babysittings. That is the death of the order. The new situation we're in is spiritually dangerous in two ways. Having families and so on means that you're much less likely to go on retreat, which means you're going to be much less likely to have the position to reflect deeply on your experience. It's on retreat that you really feel karma nirma processes activated to a degree that inspires you very often. And if we're not careful, we'll weaken the community because there isn't sufficient intensity between us. Now, I say that, and that is that danger of a more sort of lay-like life. But I've, trust me, folks, I've also been in community long enough to know that moving into community doesn't necessarily change any of that. I've had people who move in and move out without causing a ripple. Some people even seem to think that the building will do it to them. They'll just become spiritually intense by living in those four walls, which is just absurd. The conditions don't make the man. The man has to use the conditions. But it really is a question, isn't it? How do we keep this vividness of interaction alive? How do we communicate with each other in such a way as to lead us beyond our self-clinging? How do we do that now? How do we ensure that we're all of us serving a community, serving a vision that goes beyond ourselves, a tune beyond ourselves and yet tune beyond us and yet ourselves? Seems to me our great challenge now, because it's there, it's in that ring around in the garden, on the lawn today, this atmosphere that you're saying is arising. It's in the puja sometimes, it's in the moments between us where Dhamma Nirma processes are most felt in this collective world. It's when I teach, it's when a Mitra study group starts to actually move towards the ideal, that between us there it is. It's an incredible thing when that happens in Mitra study. You know, at first you think, oh, I don't like these people and this is blah, blah, blah. And then suddenly the ideal is appearing in the room as a felt presence, as a living reality, and everybody feels it. If you don't participate in it, of course you don't feel it. If you're blocked, if you're not taking part, if you're not emotionally engaging, well, of course you don't feel it. But then that's true of you looking at a painting. You can look at the most beautiful painting. If you're not participating, if you're not trying, if you're not emotionally open, well, of course you won't experience it as beautiful. Of course you won't. So those are my three things that we need to carry on learning. I think these three things are enough as well. We carry on learning. We continue committing ourselves to karma nirma processes, to ethics, and we connect with dharma nirma processes. We let the vision take over, especially in our community that we've created together and which we're trying to bring more and more people into, because that's the place they'll really get a taste of dharma nirma processes. That's where they'll go to that talk and they'll say, I loved your talk. What was it? I don't know. There was just that thing in the room. I felt it. Yeah? And last night, just to finish, we were circumambulating the stupa. And I've been making my offerings to the stupa and trying to see which part of the stupa I want to make an offering to. And I read Dado's aphorism. And I try to think, is there something that aphorism is particularly telling me? And then last night, I suddenly realised that these three things are actually the three aphorisms. So carry on learning obviously means cherish the doctrine. Committing our life to karma nirma processes, to ethics, means radiate love, and connecting with the dharma nirma processes through our shared community means to live united. Thank you.